Well, good morning. Certainly is good to see everyone here. So thankful to be able to come together and worship the Lord. Thankful for our visitors. Got a number of visitors here, and we're so appreciative of your presence with us. I tend to keep up with sort of some of the rhetoric and narratives that are going around in the world as it relates to what atheists or agnostics or unbelievers generally are saying. Like, what are the arguments? What is the narrative that they're putting forth at any given time? And I've perceived one that I want to describe to you briefly here, and what the answer or answers to this narrative is. One of the popular notions that is being advanced at this time is something goes something like this, that the ancient Israelites were a bunch of Iron Age peasants. That phrase, by the way, is used a lot as it relates to the written record of Old Testament in particular, followers of God and children of Abraham, Israelites, that they're Iron Age peasants. Sheep herders is another favorite phrase. Nomadic tribesmen is another favorite phrase. And all of these words are intended for their audience to put them into a certain category of people that is supposed to convey that these people are sort of meaningless in the overall scheme of things, and that they don't really have any real influence in the superpowers of their day, and that they really were fairly unknown except among their own groups, and that they simply come up with this idea of one God. I cannot tell you the numbers of times that I have heard this very thing spoken, that the Israelites came up with this idea that there was one God among the Gentile nations or nations around them that typically had many gods, and their claim to fame was that they believed that there was one God, and they came up with this idea. And that the point that the unbelievers are trying to make is that there's no reason to believe in the existence of Jehovah any more than there's any reason to believe in the existence of Baal or Molech or Dagon or Zeus or Odin or any of the other gods that have been, you know, worshiped by men over time. In other words, they are putting the God of the Bible, Jehovah God, in the same list and category as all the made-up idol gods of the ancient world. This is a very common theme and a common way that the world wants to categorize and group the God that we all worship as just another name in a long list of names of gods through human history. Well, I mean, and the other thing is that there's an assumed ignorance of the God of the Israelites from the majority of the superpowers of their time. And the unbelievers of today infer in making this case that there was never anything special about the God Jehovah. And as compared to any other gods of the Gentiles, and that basically what their rhetoric and their narrative is that these were all national gods. And what I mean by that is that they were mascots for the gods of the nations, and each nation had bigger and better stories about their gods that made their nation seem bigger and better than the other nations. And of course, you know, as we come into the New Testament and we see things like in Ephesus, the Temple of Diana, for example, it's, you know, extraordinary, apparently, by all accounts. Just an amazing feat of architecture, and you know many, many others could be cited along those lines. So what I want to show this morning here for a few minutes is that the God of the Bible, the God that created the heavens and the earth, as you can see on the slide here this morning, that God has never left himself without witness on the earth. The God of the Bible has never left himself without witness on the earth. Never. So that we all, in all the history of mankind from Adam and Eve forward, everybody could have known, should have known, that there was one God, and that that God was the God that had spoken to Adam and the patriarchs, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., in the beginning. And I've made a list that I would have had this on the slides, but I didn't think of it until after I'd had my slide show sort of, or presentations made. But at any rate, I made a list of, we're gonna handle one of these today. Others of these I've talked about and others have talked about in times past. But these are what I'm calling the seven C's. So I created each word with a beginning with a C so that it'll be easier to remember. And so the first one of these is creation. Of course, and as I say, I've talked about it. Lots of other people have talked about this in times past. Psalm 19. This is, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Romans 1. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhood, so that they are without excuse. Humans are without excuse to know that there is a God because of the creation. It doesn't matter what philosophies and science, falsely so-called, come up with. They're still without excuse. Number two is conscience. Another C word, conscience. People don't think about this very often. Human beings have an inborn sense of right and wrong. We are born with it. You see it in our children. You see it in every atheist have it. And they are very hard-pressed to explain it, by the way, because I see them fumbling through their answers, you know, when this subject comes. Why is it that humans have this consciousness of right and wrong within us? Well, the reason is God put it there as a testimony to our hearts. And it's mentioned in many, many areas. One of them is in Romans 2:15. The Gentiles show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, their thoughts either accusing or excusing them. Our conscience is a witness of God that is in our makeup. Number three, care for or provision for. I use the word care because it begins with a C. Care for or provision for humans and life on earth. And actually, that is where this phrase comes from. And let me just read a little bit of that because that's germane to our lesson today. This is in Acts 14. And this situation here is where Paul and Barnabas, and this is very sort of critical to the lesson this morning to kind of get this in front of us. So if you want to turn, I don't have this on the slides, but it's Acts 14. And I'm going to start in verse 8, and we'll just see this miracle that Paul performs and the reaction to it, and then his statement about the fact that God has never left himself without witness on the earth. So here we go, and in verse 8, "And in Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb, who had never walked. This man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had faith to be healed, and with a loud voice, 'Stand up straight on your feet,' and he leaped and walked. Now when the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lycaonian language, 'The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men.' And Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Zeus, whose temple was in front of the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates, intending to sacrifice with the multitudes. But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard this, they tore their clothes and ran in among the multitude, crying out and saying, 'Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God who made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that in them is, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless," here's our phrase, "nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness." And with these sayings, they could scarcely restrain the multitude from sacrificing to them. So, what's the point of this particular context here is that what's being said is that because God has continued throughout the generations to provide for mankind in that he has done good. Does everybody here eat every day? I do, nearly every day. Does everybody drink every day? Do you have a bed to sleep in? You know, I could go on. But God provides for us. And that is a testimony that God cares for us. He hasn't left us out here alone. Now, some people could say, well, there's people starving in the world today. Yes, there are people starving in the world today. But nearly all of that is because of corruption within the societies that they are starving in. But at any rate, was it David, I think, that said, "I've never seen the righteous go without bread." I've never seen the righteous go without bread. Have you? I haven't. That's just the idea that God has provided for mankind from the beginning of creation is a testimony to his existence and power. Now, number four in this list of C's, the seven C's, is certified by comparison. This is the one we're going to talk about today. Certified by comparison. Now, in Acts 14, where we just were, what happened there? Paul did a miracle that this man stood up on his feet who was born deformed in some way, and they could not walk, never walked before. Paul healed him. And what happened? Well, the priest of Zeus wanted to sacrifice to them, Paul and Barnabas, calling them Zeus and Hermes. Well, Paul says, don't do this. These things are useless. We're here to try to teach you about the God who created the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that in them is. We're trying to teach you about the real God, the one that actually does exist. So that's the one we're going to look at today. And let me give you the other three here just quickly. Sermons could be and have been made on all of these points. Number five is Christ. Christ crucified and resurrected. The greatest testimony and demonstration of the God of the universe and that he cares about mankind. Number six is Christianity and the church. The fact that there are still Christians and the existence of the church is a testimony to the world that God has been here and that he has set forth this group of people, this assembly, this people for God's own possession is a testimony to the existence of God. And the last one, number seven, is complete canon. We have here the most ancient document on earth. If you have one of these, you have the most ancient written document on earth as a translation into English. Once the apostles had written the last letter, John, the revelator, had written his last words, this is a closed system. We have a complete canon, standard, that God has given to us for till he comes back. This is it. And it's all we need. And so this too, the fact that God has revealed to us his completed will is a testimony to the existence of the God of the Bible. Now, those are the three or the seven C's. Now, what we're going to do next is we're going to go take a little run through the history of the Old Testament and just pick out a few salient points and events where this comparison, certification by comparison, is being made in the scriptures. That the God Jehovah is different than the gods of the nations. That's the point. So God did not leave himself without witness on the earth. And in fact, his name was known among the nations, not only for the sake of the nations, but also for the sake of the Israelites, because even they did not always appreciate and believe that the God that they had worshipped in time past was the God of the universe, the Almighty God. Even they at times did not believe in the God of creation. And so we'll see that as well today. One of course, as we mentioned before, we know that God spoke to the patriarchs early on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. One of Jacob's sons, of course, was Joseph. What happened to Joseph? Well, his brothers sold him to a caravan going to Egypt. Now, Egypt at the time, what was Egypt? Well, at that time, Egypt was, for all intents and purposes, the superpower of the world, of one of the earliest civilizations on earth, where humans had gathered together to create a society, a civilization with laws and, you know, with structures and with government. And so what happened to Joseph? He was sold to Potiphar's house, and because he was righteous, everything he did prospered. He prospered in the house of Potiphar until, of course, Potiphar's wife told lies about him, and then he was sent to prison, and then what did he do there? Well, he prospered in a way in prison. He became a head over the prisoners. And then eventually, of course, he interpreted by the power of God the dreams of the butler and the baker, which put him, eventually, after 2 years, put him in the throne room of Pharaoh. Now, what did he do with Pharaoh's dream? Well, he interpreted, of course, giving God the glory. He said, I can't interpret dreams, but I know someone who can. God can. And so he interprets the Pharaoh's dream as 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. So this is what... Oh, I about forgot about my slides here. I'm not sure what... There we go. That was, God has never left himself without witness. So here's Joseph interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker. And here's Joseph interprets the dreams of Pharaoh regarding the 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. Now, this is what Pharaoh says about Joseph there in Genesis 41. Listen to this. What we're trying to establish here, and the question that we're asking here, is did the nations know about the God of Israel? Well, you tell me, after we read what Pharaoh, essentially the leader of the known world, at least in the world that we know of, have any information about, this is what he said. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this man in who is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning as wise and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck, and he made him ride in the second chariot, and they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Now I ask you, did this greatest civilization of the ancient world know that there was a man that had the Spirit of God in him? Yes. The very president, Pharaoh, knew. And undoubtedly, others would know because of what happened as time went along. So, Joseph who by the power of God makes this already great country, this nation, even greater in power and wealth over time, over those 14 years. Because all the other nations who ran out of food, what were they doing? They were coming to Egypt. And they were selling everything they had in order to get grain that Joseph had stored in these huge grain bins in Egypt. So it is there in Egypt, in fact, that eventually Joseph's brothers and father, Jacob, come to Egypt during the later years of the famine and come to dwell in the land of Goshen. And there, after 430 years, they become a great nation in that they were great in number. In fact, they were so great in number that the Egyptians feared them. And the Pharaoh, who eventually came, that did not know Joseph, really, and didn't know what Joseph had done for the land of Egypt, but all he saw was a threat to him. And so he said, we need to do something about this. We need to enslave these people and put them in bondage. And so it came to pass that Pharaoh tried to destroy all the little male babies of this generation. It was the abortion of his time, an extermination of a lineage. And because they were reproducing, so we got to get rid of, you hear a lot about overpopulation these days. Well, it relates to this as well. But what in this context, who was born? Moses. Now, Moses was put in this little basket, and he was found by who? Pharaoh's daughter. And Pharaoh's daughter takes him up, names him Moses because he was drawn out of the water. And Pharaoh's daughter takes him in as her own. He is trained in all the wisdom, educated in the knowledge of the Egyptians, which was considerable. Look at what the Egyptians were doing. That knowledge was, they were bright people, smart. They had a lot to teach. And so in this context, Moses was born. Well, eventually, of course, Moses ends up killing an Egyptian because he was mistreating one of the Hebrews and ended up having to flee, going out to the land of Midian, and becomes a shepherd out there. And it is out there that God calls Moses in the burning bush. Sorry about that. That was where Joseph, I'm behind on my slides again. Here we go. God calls Moses through the burning bush. It was a bush that was burning but was not consumed. It was on fire. It contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. There's new energy being put into this bush. It's not corrupting. It's not being consumed. So Moses goes to look at this, of course, and God calls him through this burning bush. And God said that I've heard the groans of my people and the hard life that they have because of Pharaoh. And he says, I'm going to take them and deliver them, and I'm going to take them to a land flowing with milk and honey. And God, through the process of this, exacts 10 plagues on Egypt, to where at the end of these 10 plagues, essentially the Egypt that was no more. His servants, Pharaoh's come to him, do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? You don't know yet that our civilization has fallen because of these plagues? They're coming to Pharaoh saying this. And he's, I guess, in his palace and he doesn't perceive what's going on. That kind of thing continues, by the way. But, and finally, the Israelites are set free and they go out toward the Red Sea, and Pharaoh changes his mind about letting them go. He goes after them, and what does God do? God parts the waters with Moses as leader, holds up his staff, and these huge waters of the Red Sea part, and the Israelites go through on dry land, and the Egyptian armies, of course, go in to follow them. And what happens to them? The waters come back and they're all drowned in the sea. So I ask you again, do the nations know about the God of the Bible? Jehovah, yes. They know about the God of the Bible. And we'll continue to see that that is the case. God has not left himself without witness on the earth. The Egyptians knew about the God of the Israelites. And God, of course, out in the wilderness, met with them at Mount Sinai. And he gave them the Ten Commandments. He gave them the law. He provided for them in the wilderness. They worshiped in the tabernacle. They were on their way to the promised land. And because of unbelief, they had to wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. And when they went back finally to the promised land and were about to go in, Joshua and Caleb were the only ones left from the original generation. And they here they are going, and what do? They send spies over there, and they happen upon a woman who is, I'm afraid is out of order. Let me see here. I think I skipped one. I meant to have a picture of Rahab. And the spies that she hid in the shocks of wheat or whatever it was, corn. Now, what did Rahab say about, now this is Jericho, what did Rahab say about these people? Here it is. Joshua 2 and verse 8 through 11. Now before they lay down, she, that's Rahab, came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard, did they know? That's the question. Remember that. For we have heard how the Lord, that is Jehovah, dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did there remain any more courage in anymore because of you. For the Lord, Jehovah, your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. What's the conclusion of Rahab and the people of the land of Canaan, the people of Jericho? Because of witness of what God had done in Egypt has spread to the nations, and Rahab, a harlot, knows the God of Israel. They know the God of Israel. So, again, this business about Israel being some sheep herders in the wilderness and nobody knowing about them is complete and utter lie. It is not true. They did know about the God of Israel. And he made himself manifest and apparent and obvious time and time and time again. So, God has not left himself without witness in the earth. And it would be easy enough to, you know, look at the conquest of Canaan, starting with Jericho. And again, when it's all conquered, you know, did the nations know about Israel? Of course, the answer would be yes. And also during the glory days of the kingdom of David and Solomon, you know, the Queen of Sheba came to Solomon at one point because she had heard way down south about Solomon. Well, isn't that something? Incidentally, the Ethiopian eunuch knew about Israel, didn't he? He was from Ethiopia. That's a long ways from Israel. The nations knew about Israel. And what did the Queen of Sheba said? She said, "The half has not been told me." What does that mean? That means this is twice as amazing and wondrous as I was even told. That's what the Queen of Sheba said. The half has not been told. Did the nations know about the God of Israel? Yes, they knew about the God of Israel over and over and over again. God has never left himself without witness on the earth. Never. He never has, and he never will. Now, we're going to come to one last one here. Remember that toward the beginning of this lesson that not only I said that God dropped into the nations from time to time just to let them know who he was, but also he dropped in on his own people because they had forgotten who he is. Very sad. But they had forgotten what God had done for them. And here in 2 Kings, we're going to read a bit of a longer passage here, but it's worth it because it's really good. And this is in 1 Kings 18. So if you'd like to turn there in your Bibles, this is an amazing event that happens here with Elijah. Israel had an evil king named Ahab, and Ahab had an equally evil wife named Jezebel. And Jezebel wanted to kill all the servants of God so that the worship of Baal would be the exclusive worship of the nation. This is a bad woman, and Ahab was a bad man. He was a bad king that had a bad wife. And so, there was Moses, sorry about that. Well, we'll leave that up for now. I thought there were a few more slides than that, but at any rate. That's Elijah. That's the one I wanted. So, here, we're going to start in verse 17 of 1 Kings 18. Now listen to this. Listen to this. This is an amazing event here with Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Now again, we're asking the question that the gods or that the people of the nations know, and did Israel know? Well, they had to be reminded from time to time who the real God was. And this is one of those times. Verse 17, "Then it happened when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, 'Is that you, O troubler of Israel?' And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you have forsaken the commandment of the Lord and followed the Baals, or Baals, as some people pronounce. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent for all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. And Elijah came to all the people and said, how, listen to this phrase, we need to be asking this today. To everybody on earth needs to be asking this question. How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people answered him not a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Therefore, let them give us two bulls, and let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire under it. Then you call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. So all the people answered and said, it is well spoken. Now Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one bull for yourselves and prepare it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. So they took the bull which was given to them and prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning till noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. But there was no voice. No one answered. Then they leaped about on the altar which they had made, and soon it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry out, for he is a god. Either he is meditating, or he is busy, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he's sleeping, or must be awakened. So they cried out, cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances, until blood gushed out of them. And when midday was past, they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. This is a competition between the gods of the world and the God of the Bible. Verse 30, then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down. And Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Israel shall be your name. Then with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar large enough to hold two seahs of seed. And he put the wood in order, cut the bull in pieces, and laid it on the wood, and said, fill four water pots of water and pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood. Then he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. So the water ran all around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Now, has anybody ever tried to build a fire after a rain when the wood is wet? That's really hard, isn't it? It's not just hard, it's impossible. If your wood is completely saturated with water, you cannot build a fire. So listen to what happens. So the water ran all around the altar, and it filled the trench with water. Verse 36, and it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God, and that you have turned their hearts back to you again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, The Lord, He is God! The Lord, He is God! And Elijah said to them, Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. Now, did the Israelites know that the God that had brought them out of Egypt, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was the God that answers by fire? He's the God that actually heard his servant Elijah. All the prophets of Baal were cutting themselves and prophesying from morning till noon, and not a word. But Elijah says a simple prayer, and the Lord, fire comes down from heaven and consumes everything. No, this is certification by comparison. This is a comparison between two peoples. Well, they were the same peoples, actually, but there was a comparison there between two, a figment of their imagination, Baal, a made-up God, a created God, and the God that created the universe. And God makes himself known. There's a lot more that I could say. I'm running long already. We're gonna quit. There's going to be a part B to this, at least, and maybe a part C. We'll see how it goes. So thank you for your patience. If there's anyone here that we can help in any way, draw closer to the real God, the one who created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, we would love to see you come to the Lord and get closer to your Creator through Jesus Christ. If we can help you in any way, come forward while together we stand and sing the chosen song.